This is January 23, 1964. We have with us this evening one of Fairbanks' most distinguished citizens, Mr. John Butterwich, state legislature, and native Fairbankson, who will tell his experience to the association. I'll now turn this over to Mr. Butterwich.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Pinal Yukon Historical Society, my name is John Butterwich, and I have lived in Alaska for 53, almost 54 years. I was born on Fairbanks Creek, on 8 below Fairbanks Creek in 1910. Never saw salt water until I was 19 years old, and that was 10 years too soon as far as I'm concerned. My dad stampeded to Alaska in 1897 and came in over Chilkoot Pass and stampeded to the Karkuk country. He was in there with Gordon Bettles and Fred Swift and Jim Tobin, the father of Emily Tobin, who edited and owned the Alaska Sportsman for so many years. And he was a prospector, came up here looking for gold like most of the old timers of that era did. He didn't find very much. He never was really a miner, mostly a prospector. And when I was about 6 months old, the folks were mining on Fairbanks Creek, and they gave that up and moved into Fairbanks. And we bought the home of Los Bernard, who was an early day newspaper man here, up at in the 700 block on 7th Avenue. And our neighbors at that time, I was only 6 months old, but our neighbors at that time were the parents of Bob Crawford, a chap who became quite a composer and composed the Air Force song, among others. And we lived there all of my younger part of my life. In fact, until I was married, we lived in the same place, same location, and kids went to school in the old frame school building that burned down in 1932. We were very fortunate. We had a lot of good teachers in those days. They taught you to read and write and spell, had a little arithmetic, and if you happen to be in business nowadays and are interviewing people who want to work for you, you can perhaps know what I'm hinting about. We had fine schools. We didn't have any school buses. We walked to school. The winters were just as severe then, probably more severe than they are now. But we had a lot of good things, too. The economy was completely different. There are so many things that are history that are just commonplace to people nowadays. For instance, I suppose in those days there were more horses, or as many horses in Fairbanks as there were people. We didn't have but one or two automobiles. We had I remember Stanley Steamer and some old chain drive rigs, some of them with solid tires. And I was a pretty good-sized kid before the automobiles became very popular. We didn't have too much in the way of roads, but people got around. We had the old Peavine Railroad that ran out to Chattanooga. It was a narrow gauge, but finished adequate transportation. And I can remember in those early days driving out to the creeks with Hosey Ross and Fred Parker and some of the old-timers, and right out on Engineer Hill, we'd have to stop many times in the fall of the year and let the caribou go by before we could go on about our business. And, there are just a lot of things that made living in those days real fine. I don't consider myself a real old-timer, but at least I was around before the transition to the Huckleberry Buck motorized life that we live in today. I was almost a grown man before I knew what a flush toilet was. And I think there are a lot of people who lived here in those days that were in the same predicament that I was. I know that I never used a telephone until I was 10 years old, I'm sure. And it was a slow-moving world, but I've been over most of Alaska by one means of transportation or another, most of it in an airplane. And when I get back from some of those trips that I've taken up into the Arctic and down into Kuskokwim and Bristol Bay and up north, Barrow, and around, and you think, well, it's pretty tough. It was a rough day. And then I get to thinking, and I realize that my dad walked over most of that country that I flew over. He walked over it. And I know that he walked in and out of the Kayakut 5 times. And I recall the last time he came out, he walked into Fairbanks on Thanksgiving Day, 1926. He'd been gone for 3.5 years. And of course, I was 2.5 years old when he left and 6 years old when he came back. So he was a stranger. And believe me, he continued to be a stranger because he was away so much when I was a kid that I was almost raised by my mother. And it says here, what did she do? Well, she worked. That's about all she did was work. And that's about what you had to do if you're going to raise a family and survive in those days. My dad being a prospector and not being one of the lucky ones, why, we still had to eat and be clothed, and we got it the best way we could. We started out working when we were pretty young, and when I was about 7, I started to work in a truck garden for Paul Rickert. And he had 80 acres of truck garden and about 6 hothouses in those days. Of course, we didn't have any airborne fresh stuff, and the only fresh stuff we had was what was raised. And I can remember in the spring of the year, one of the chores us kids had to do was to take the cans up and dump them in the slough, the tin cans. And my brother and I could take all the tin cans we used all winter long in a gunny sack apiece, take them to the dump. Now, if the garbage man misses coming around every Tuesday, well, we got tin cans overflowing the garbage pail and all over on the ground. And it shows you, gives you an idea of how we live. We ate a lot of dried stuff, fruit, and all kinds of rice, beans, and good solid food. Didn't hurt us any. But not much canned stuff, canned milk. I was 11 years old before I tasted fresh milk. It was a real good life. It always makes me feel bad when we bury another pioneer, to think that so much of the history is buried with him. In fact, with the exception of a few chronicles that were written years ago, very little of the history, the everyday history, which is, after all, the history, the commonplace everyday things, when you add them all up, are the history of a country or the development of a country, and we lose so much of it. Judge Wickersham captured a lot of it in his old Yukon, but there aren't too many books like that. There are a few that deal with explorations, but the everyday living and the funny things that go on that are history, a lot of them are lost. I mean, we've had a lot of characters up here, but they die and they don't put anything down on paper, and as a result, unless it's handed down from mouth to mouth, why, it goes out the window. And it seems too bad, but then people are busy too, and we move a lot faster than we used to. I don't think we record as much of it as we did 50 years ago. So I think you people have a splendid idea in what you're attempting to do here. I think it's very good. So what are your hobbies? Well, I'm indulging in a hobby now that should interest you people. Has a lot of history connected with it, and that is the collecting of Alaska trade tokens. In the early days, wasn't too much hard money when you got away from the cities because of transportation. And the traders all up and down the Yukon and in the Arctic, in the Northwest, and to the east of us too, over as far as Eagle, all manufactured their own money. They all had tin money manufactured and redeemed in trade. It was one way of controlling the trade in the area, and it also got away from that business of having to bring in your silver money. They did use quite a bit of gold money, however, in those days. But I started in collecting this stuff about 30 years too late. I handled a lot of it as a youngster. I brought a few samples I'm here to pass around and let you take a look at, some that I've acquired just recently. And I'll, there's a lot of history connected to these things. I brought just a few that I've. This is the Alstrom Trading Company in Alakanut. And they have their denominations from 25 cents, 50 cents, $1, $5, $10, and $20. He had a pretty complete set of currency. And these are, incidentally, getting awfully hard to come by, and it's really too bad because these are Dominic Vanetti's, and he's a Kayakuk, of course, and he burned, and a lot of his went up when the fire came along, and that set wasn't in the fire, however. I got another set here from Alstrom, and this is Quigget, K-W-I-G-U-K, Quigget. I think I brought another one here. Yeah, this is a real tough set here. It's a complete set. It's a real tough one to come by. It's the Nervik Cooperative Store. It's over on the West Coast. And some of these are just about gone. I wrote to a lady in Kotzebue the other day, tried to get a set of Ferguson bingos from Archie Ferguson, the trader up in Kotzebue, and she wrote me back and she said she had a set of them, but she didn't want to part with them. Well, I didn't want her to. I wasn't asking her for any she had. I wanted to find out if she could run down some for me. And she said that when they outlawed them, which they have by law, they have outlawed them, why, Archie took all his that he had and dumped them in a well. And then a few of them showed up and people started asking for them, so he tried to dig them up, and I guess he did get a few of them. She said some of them were in pretty bad shape. But that, of course, is what has happened to these things. A lot of the trading posts burned down, of course, a lot of them burned up. There's a lot of history. When you get them all together and start looking at them, I got one from Dawson the other day, and I couldn't figure out if there's a 25, there's about 3 or 4 bit piece. It was from a place that sold fine liquors. It's really an old brass thing. A fellow told me he had it for 40 years. And in beautiful shape, but on the other side of it, it said on it, Dawson YT, good for, and then it had these gizmos down there, and I thought they were some kind of Greek insignias, and I wasn't too sharp, so I asked somebody to look at it and tell me what those things were, and they told me, they said, well, they're two bits, two horse bits. So the coin said on it, good for, blank, and here these two bits were put on there, and the bits they put in the horse's mouth, so it was good for two bits in trade. But I mean, there are a lot of interesting things like that, and some of these coins are terrific. They've done a beautiful job on some of them. I've got some that are 60, 70 years old, and they're awfully hard to come by. There's about 600 or 700 different sets all together, and some people in Jura have about 500 of them, and I guess I have about 100 sets. I started too late with too little, but it's really a lot of history. And speaking of history, it all works in with this museum hike that the pioneers are on, that I hope maybe someday we'll have, I don't know, but there's a lot of plunder that's being lost right now and every day, and has for the last 50 years, that really belonged in a museum. For example, when Gus Conrad quit the country and started to sell his plunder, or get rid of it, I don't know, I suppose he sold it or gave it away, but he called me over to his house, and I went over there, and he said, maybe you want to buy this chair. And he had a black leather swing back rocker, a black leather one. And I said, well, my golly, you know, I just couldn't believe that they made swing back rockers in that old black leather like you used to see in the lobbies of the hotels 50 and 60 years ago. And he said, you know, he gave me that chair. And I said, no, he said, Clarence Berry. He said, Clarence Berry had that chair out in Esther. If you don't know who Clarence Berry is, he was one of the early day miners who made a fortune on Esther Creek and mined out in the Bonneville country also. I don't think he made any money out there, however. But he put in the longest ditch in the country, in the Bonneville country, in the early days, with a baggage, too, horses and baggage scraper. But I have his swing back rocker. That thing ought to be in a museum, because you don't see anything like that nowadays. It's all it is in the way, as far as I'm concerned. I have another interesting item that I'm not looking to give away, but it's the only one I ever saw. I suppose the old timers probably have seen a lot of them, and that is a folding rocking chair that was packed over Chokee Pass. It folds right up just like these folding chairs, only it's a rocking chair. And it's a little jewel, I tell you. But, in recent years, we spent a lot of time on the Goodpaster River, a tributary of the Tenn on the right limit. It comes in 12 miles above Big Deal on the highway, and we got there 70 miles. We've got a couple of camps up there, and we had a friend who went in there in 1909 and lived there until he died in 1958. And we buried him up there, in fact, in front of one of his caches. But he kept a diary from the day he got off the boat in Valdez until about a week before he died. And I have that diary. It's in, not one book, but 50 books, all in pencil. And it's really something. I tell you, there's a lot of history there. He was the stage driver for the NC Company and used to take people across the... used to take the first cars that ran the highway across to, they'd take two poling boats and put them alongside each other and straddle the boats, put the two right-hand wheels of the car in one boat and left-hand wheels in the other boat and pull it across the river there at Big D. And to get back to the highway, when Frank Young and Edby Davis and all the kids were around here, there was no bridge across the Salcher River either. We went across that on a ferry. I'm sure Frank remembers when Teddy Gray used to run the ferry across to Munson's, or what we call Salcher now. There's no bridge there then. And Birch Lake in those days was quite an expedition. If you could get out there and back, it was quite a successful weekend, believe me. Most of the time you were traveling, too. I remember John Minardo told me one time, he paid $125 for the privilege of helping push a Model T Ford from Valdez to Fairbanks, and it took 24 days. So, sometimes when we think we're roughing it, we should turn back the pages a little ways. Well, I don't know. I think I could tell you an interesting thing that I heard not too long ago. We go duck hunting. We have a duck hunting camp on Healy Lake, and that's up the Tanna River, about 60 miles above Big D. And when we were kids here in Fairbanks, back before the flu epidemic in 17 or 18 or 19, whenever it was, the bad flu epidemic, we had a tremendous Indian village down at Shooter. An awful lot of those Indians died off in the flu epidemic, as they did in all the other villages. And a lot of the Chula natives moved up to Salt Jacket, and then progressively moved up. And at one time, there were 2,000, there was a village of 2,000 natives at the mouth of the Good Pasture. And they eventually moved on up to Healy Lake. And there was a big village there, and Mrs. Kirkstetter, who lives up there now, is married to Paul Kirkstetter, was telling us, in flying over there, up the Healy River Valley, I noticed it looked like windrows along there in places, and I was curious, and we took a pretty good look at it, and we couldn't figure out what it was. And so next time I saw Margaret, I said, Margaret, what's all that stuff up the river? And she said, well, that's caribou fence. And I said, a caribou fence? And she said, yeah, in the early days, when her mother and grandmother and father and grandfather were living, the natives took and made these pole caribou fences. And they made them like a corral, like a funnel. They took them from the hills on either side and took them right down for 7 or 8 miles and just gradually narrowed them up until they got them right down into a funnel. Of course, the caribou came down off the hills and piled into the open mouth of these caribou fences and just went down. And then they laid there at first with spears and bow and arrows and killed them. And then when they got guns and ammunition, when they got a trading post up there and got guns and ammunition, then they slaughtered them, of course, with the rifles. And I had never heard of that or been told about it until I talked to Mr. Kirkstetter. Now, that, of course, that's something that the old-timers would know about and keep to themselves, you see. But to me, it was interesting because that was a pretty efficient way of getting a lot of meat in a hurry. They walked right down to the slaughtering place. And you can still see, if you're flying over that country, you can still see those fences. They built them 6 or 7 feet high out of dry poles. It was all done with dry poles. And it looks just like a farmer's fence, what you can see of it, only it's a little higher. And I couldn't figure out what it was in flying over it. Just,
still standing?
Oh, yes, there's big chunks of it, you know. 100 feet of it in places still standing. And of course, a lot of it there isn't a trace of. But there's up the Healy Valley. See, there's about 4 branches of the Healy River come down and form Rumsey Healy Lake just before the river dumps into the Tanna River. All the channels of the Healy run through Healy Lake. And we went in there duck hunting first about 20 years ago. We really thought that we were getting into new country. Well, I got talking to my trapper friend up the Good Pasture, and he said, well, he says, you know, Tom King and I took a prospect boat 30 miles up the Healy River, he said, in 1914. So, I mean, and anywhere you go in this great big hunk of land of Alaska here, and so many places that I've been wandering around thinking that you're right out in the middle of nowhere, and just about the time you wonder to yourself if anybody's been around you, you kick an old rusty tin can, or you see the remains of a fallen down cabin buried in the ground, and you realize that, boy, those fellows who were looking for gold in the early days, they did a lot of hiking. They covered an awful lot of territory. I know that I was up on the Bettles River 4 or 5 years ago, and way out in the middle of nowhere, and on one creek, I bet I saw the remains of 15 cabins, just on one creek alone. And of course, that was an interesting country to be in, because my dad was up there before the turn of the century, and he and another chap by the name of Fred Swift were prospecting, and they starved out, and the Arctic coast was closer than anywhere else they could go, so they went up through one of the passes and made it to an Eskimo village on the Arctic coast, and I asked him what they used for food, and he said, well, actually, before they got through, all they had to eat was rose haws and condensed milk. We used to get this canned milk that was sweet and it was thick, gooey stuff. We used a lot of that.
Yeah, we used a lot of that in the early days up here. In fact, that's all we did use outside of the condensed mill. But I flew over that roughly the same route that my dad and this fellow walked over, and believe me, it was a rugged journey. It had to be, and they had to be awfully tough to make it. And he said that, of course, I met Fred Swift, and I suppose quite a few of the people who knew the kayak knew who he was. He was up there for a long time. And, my dad said when they were getting out, they hit a dog trail, and they were, after they'd gone over on the other side, and they were following a dog, a pretty good dog trail, and he said Swift was in pretty bad shape, and he'd walk ahead of him, get ahead of him quarter mile or a half mile, and then stop and get ready for him, and get a tablespoon, and Swift would see him getting this canned milk out, and he'd make an effort and walk up, and the old man would give him a tablespoon of condensed milk and a couple of these rose haws, and then he'd walk away and leave him and lure him on that way. And he said they were going along, and he thought he was losing his marbles. He imagined he was hearing music, and he said it was cold and clear and cold, and they kept walking and walking. He heard this for so long, and he said finally they came around a bend, and there was a village, and they had music. They had one of these old disc phonographs that they got off a whaler, you know, and they were playing that. So he had a great feeling of admiration for the Eskimos in the Natives. He said that before the white people came along and not all the evils of civilization, they were really fine people and treated them wonderfully well. And he had nothing but admiration for them. And I know that's hard for people to believe nowadays, some people, but I believe it. I think they were probably really fine people until we disrupted their way of life to their disadvantage. Don't you think I've talked enough?
No, we'd like to hear a lot more.
Tell us
more
about your boyhood around here.
What
you
call
it, just
for
fun?
Well, we were juvenile delinquents. I'm sure we were. Well, I'm sure we were by modern standards, I think. But we worked a lot. I don't remember when I wasn't self-sufficient. It had to be before I was 7 years old, because I know that from then on I didn't ask anybody for anything. And I'm very thankful that that was the case, that I was lucky enough to have parents that had sense enough to teach me how to work and to know how to work. But I want to get back to my the early early days here, as far as agriculture is concerned. We've had quite a revival in agriculture the last few years, but when I was a kid, I did work for Paul Rickert, and he was a tremendous gardener. He had he started right out here. His place started right where the Glen Willis, the owner of that, the West Trucker, West Insurance Office is, and went right down Cushman Street to the south. He had 80 acres there in truck stuff, and he had five or six greenhouses. And I worked for him in 2020, 21, 22, 23, 24. I worked every summer for him, and after schools and on Saturdays. He had a hothouse he raised sweet corn in, and he had another hothouse that he raised eggplant and cantaloupe in, and he raised the most wonderful tomatoes and cucumbers, peppers, radishes, lettuce, and all that sort of stuff, just as good, if not better, than anything we buy today. And besides that, he had this tremendous 80 acres of truck guard produce, which he sold to
people in town, and of course all the way to Chattanooga and downriver and upriver. And really was a successful farmer. He never, as far as I know, had any kind of subsidy of any kind from any subdivision of the government. He whacked it all out by himself, and he wasn't alone. We had a lot of farmers in those days. I remember the day we laid the cornerstone for the university. I rode out the university in a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, with Roy Schaefer. He had a farm out on the farm loop out here. And all these places that are building up now in little acreage and homes, were cleared and cultivated in the early days. You can go right around the farm loop. And most of that country was under cultivation at one time, starting at Belaine's place and going right on around. And even down the Tananaw, there were two or three farmers down in the Tananaw between here and Nenana, raised a lot of produce, tremendous amount of it. But people here nowadays are just like people are in the States. They like city life. They don't like that old business from 3 a.m. till 3 a.m. That's too tough for most people. The agricultural economy in the States is having the same thing. If it wasn't for machinery, we'd starve to death, because people just won't farm like they used to. They won't get out and put in the kind of hours and work the way they did. But we had farmers up here. Paul Rickard is a doggone good farmer, tremendous farmer. And he wasn't alone. They had the experiment station down at Rampart, and that's where George Gasser, I first heard of George Gasser was at Rampart. And we had Jimmy Weiss up to Chena, and old Harry Badger out on the Badger Road, Macaulay, just any number of a guy across the river, Sam Charlie. We had any number of successful farmers who made a living at it. We even had a flour mill and ground some wheat up, made some local flour. We used it too. Probably wasn't the best flour in the world, but my mother made bread in those days, and we surely used the local flour. And of course, I predict that eventually we'll do the same thing again, but it is interesting to know that we had a lot of those things that we probably will go back to and people will make a success of 50 years afterwards again. But there was certainly a period in between when it kind of went to pot. Everybody gave up, and I suppose that the same things motivated people up here that did in the States. They could make a living easier doing something else. But I think that it has a place in our economy, no question of it at all. Since I got on this bingo hike, trade token hike, I've been, of course, trying to remember a lot of old-timers that I knew many years ago, and I think of a lot of these people who, I always get a kick out of the Sourdough Express ad, this sourdough since 98, and the first sourdough I knew around here, the first Sourdough Express was Sourdough Ellis, and Frank remembers him, his competitor was a guy by the name of Larry Lillico, if you remember. And Pinkerton, remember Pink?
Yeah.
They had the old Express deal.
Do you remember when they started the flour mill there?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What year was that? Do you remember?
No, but we were using it had to be before World War I, because we were using the flour during World War I. We were Hooverizing.
Yeah,
What is that?
Oh,
he was one of the fellows who promoted the flour mill, the original mill. Oh, yeah, and you want to know what we did when we were kids? We were always trying to make a buck, you know. And every time I think of old Martin Murphy was, when Martin was one of the fellows in the restaurant, he had a Dutchman for a partner, August Berglund, and we used to pick blueberries. We'd go out to Esther Siding and pick a couple of 5-gallon cans of blueberries and bring them in, and catch a speeder out there. We could ride out on a little speeder on the railroad and cost you 2 bits each way, and we could fill a couple of 5-gallon cans of blueberries there at Esther Siding pretty fast. And we'd bring them in, and we sold the blueberries to Martin Nuffy. And then as soon as the grouse season opened in the fall, well, we'd go out and shoot grouse, and of course, until 1924, I think it was 24, we could sell them.
Yeah.
I think that's when the Game Commission came into being, wasn't it? We used to sell the grouse to Gus Berglund. He was the chap who handled the meat in the old model, and I don't know what size meals they put out in those days, because we could never afford to eat in a restaurant, believe me. But we had the different species of grouse that we'd sell, and they would pay $1 for a royal grouse, which we call a white meat grouse. And they'd pay 6 bits for a pintail grouse. And they'd pay 50 cents for spruce hens. And they would buy ptarmigan 3 for $1 under protest. They'd rather not have them, actually. But I market hunted a lot, did a lot of market shooting, that is birds. And we had a little Englishman lived here in Fairbanks. His name was Alec Reed, and he lived up at the corner of 5th and Lacey Street there in a little cabin that, they put a storefront on it. Lucille Alvin owned it for a while, right on the corner of 5th and Lacey. Anyway, his name was Alec Reed. He had the first automatic shotgun I'd ever seen, and he really slaughtered the grouse in those days. And I used to go out and, I don't know, a single barrel 16-gauge shotgun. I'd shoot what grouse I could to that and sell them, and then I had after school I'd go up and make the rounds of go to the Merchant's Cafe and the U.S. Grill and the Model and the Arcade and take the orders for grouse, and if I couldn't fill them, then I'd go up and get grouse from Reed's. He'd hang them up in the woodshed, you know, and they'd freeze just different aboard, and I'd pick up these grouse, of course, and I'd get them. If I sold $1, if I brought in $5, well, I got $1.25 for handling the birds. And of course, that was a lot of money in those days. And of course, we delivered papers for old man Thompson, W.F. Thompson. And that was an education in itself, working around that newspaper establishment when W.F. Thompson was there, because he was an institution. He was a great writer, a terrific writer, a terrific editorial writer, some of the finest editorials I've ever read in those old news liners. He was a real great American, fine man, and a good newspaper man. But as I get interested in this token and bingo hike of collecting these old trade tokens, why, I get to thinking about all the old-timers and old man Hurley, who used to have the horse-drawn water wagon, and Fred Mushard, who was the other waterman, his competition, and they used to drive go around with these tanks on sleds in the wintertime with the 2 5-gallon pails, and you'd buy a dozen of these water tickets. And we had, of course, we didn't have water in the house. That is, we didn't have it until 1950. We lived there 40 years without water in the house. We bought water for 40 years. And those water tickets, everybody used them because inside plumbing was, believe me, a luxury. And a lot of people didn't have it. And everybody that didn't have it either melted snow or bought water from the water wells, and you had these cardboard tickets.
Well, I'd like to find some of those cardboard tickets. I've really been looking for them. We have hundreds and hundreds of them, but I can't find any. Can't even find one for my collection.
Johnny, you ever go out and cut ice and put it up for summer?
No, we never cut ice. We melted a lot of snow. We always had a couple of 100-gallon good barrels in the house for the water supply, but we didn't, in fact, when I tried to modernize the old family home, my dad just about had a hemorrhage. He didn't want any of the modern stuff, but once it was put in, he used it. It's funny, you know, how they can acclimate themselves to it. They weren't going to have an electric stove, they wanted to burn wood. Well, you got to the point where life had generated the electricity cheaper than I could buy the wood, let alone buy the juice from the utility company. I was trying to rustle wood to keep that old wood stove going. I got to the point where I couldn't cut it anymore, and it was too expensive to buy. So, but we lived right up pretty close to the old NC wood yard, and when I was a kid, the steam generating plant was a wood burner, you know. That's the only kind of fuel they had to generate steam with. There was no coal in those days, no way to get to the coal. They knew the coal was down at Healy, but there was no way to get in here. And I remarked that there were probably as many horses in town as there were people, and I think there were when I was a kid, because there was an awful lot of wood cut and hauled into this town. The NC used to stack up 10 or 12,000 cords up there between Billamore and Barnett. They ran a track up there, a car track, and they used to have these cars that had flying shrills on them, just like railroad cars, only they were just little flat cars with end stakes on them, and they put a cord of wood on each car, and they'd always have 15 or 20 cars loaded up there, and then they'd take a team of horses and go up and hitch onto the front car and pull them down, and the tracks ran right into the old power plant over here, the old NC power plant over here on the corner of 2nd and Turner. They'd run those cars right in, run them through just like they do the railroad cars over here at the coal bunker. And we had nothing but wood fire steam boilers in those days. And of course, the wood cutting on the river was a big deal. A lot of people were employed cutting wood for the boats. They cut wood all winter for the boats to use in the summer. I've seen 6 boats tied up there in front of where the NC is now at one time when I was a kid. In fact, old Captain McCann was our neighbor. He lived right up the corner of 7th and Barnett. He's captain on the Yukon for years and years and years. And I can remember when the boys all went away from Fairbanks, all the young people moved out of Fairbanks down to Fort Gibbon in World War I, and they took them all by, they marched them down to the pier down here and right in front of where the NC is now and loaded them on the river boats and moved them down to Fort Gibbon to the Army post that way. I don't know, did they catch you, N.F.?
May I interrupt you now just a minute while I turn the tape? This is the second side of Johnny Bartovich's story of his life, but they've taken at the Tamaraw Yukon Historical Society and the Chamber Log Cabin here at Fairbanks, Alaska.
Yeah, well, while we're talking about river boating and all the boats that came in here, of course, in those days, pile driver slew was not marked off, and we had a pretty good flow of water through the Chuna here, and in fact, at one time, they diverted the Tamaraw, deliberately diverted it into Pile Driver Slough to bring more water through town here, and we had some pretty good boats pull right up in front of where the NC Company is now. You've got pictures of them, I'm sure. I know the Pioneers have, with the Julia B and the Yukon and Alaska and White Seal, Swatka, all those old river boats. And when you speak of polars,
Somebody mentioned Grace Fisher a while ago, and Walter Fisher was one of the greatest rivermen who ever lived in Alaska or anywhere else. And another great boatsman was Tom Blaylock. And that name should ring a bell with Frank Young. I don't suppose anybody else ever heard that name, but he was a real riverman. And, of course, Patty Doherty, who lived at Richardson when he was an old man, lived right there past the roadhouse. Patty Doherty was, he hired out. He pulled prospect outfits from Richardson Roadhouse, clear up to the Shoshana. And if you know where the Shoshana is, why... They put 1,500 pounds of supplies in the riverboat and pull it all the way from Fred Wilkins' store at Richardson clear up to the Shoshana Stampede. I tried to pull a boat across the Tanana just from shore to shore one time. Lost a half mile doing it. And I really didn't, I didn't feel I was a complete amateur either. But those fellows would take a poling boat with 1,500 to 1,800 pounds and go all day. Work from one side of the river to the other in the slack current. And I crossed a big delta with my trapper friend, Lawrence Johnson, and he'd go straight across. He'd take a pole and go right across from shore to shore, just like that. And Patty Doherty, of course, was put those outfits in commercially, and that's where everybody practically outfitted for the Stampede. In those days, Big Delta was McCarty. They called Big Delta McCarty. It was McCarty Post Office, and Army Post was there. The U.S. Signal Corps was there. When they brought in the first telephone line from Valdez, they brought it into Big D, and then they went up the Tanana River to the Goodpaster River, and they went up the Goodpaster River to the head of the Goodpaster, and then dropped over into the Mile, and that's, Eagle was the seat, the court seat in those days, not Fairbanks, and they put the first line into Eagle, and the lieutenant who was in charge of that work, of course, was Billy Mitchell, later of Air Force fame. And our trapper's main cabins on the Goodpaster at Goodpaster Forks and at Central on the Goodpaster, and then clear up at the head of the river, they were all cabins that were built by the United States Signal Corps under then Lieutenant Billy Mitchell, who took the line up there. And of course, that line was only used for a very few years, really, but wandering around up there now, hunting wise. Every once in a while, we run into a horn that's a caribou horn or a moose horn that's all tangled up in the phone wire, and then we also find these glass insulators every once in a while on a down tree where they've fallen down. But after they took that line into Eagle, then Mitchell took that line to Nome, that same line. He had charge of that. They went from Eagle. Yeah. Eagle's Nome.
I ran across that line over on Gold Creek and Willow Creek in 40 miles.
Yeah, well, that of course, was... In 1932, I was up the Goodpaster in 1932, and it was the first time I really got way up there because... even in 1932, as I recall, we used an old Kale outboard that ran 5 minutes and then didn't run for an hour and then ran another 5 minutes. Most of the time we were necking the boat or poling it. I got way up there, and we used canned butter in 1932 that Billy Mitchell left there. That butter was 28 years old. Canned butter. Now, Golden State butter from California. Golden State was a brand. Never forget it. There wasn't a thing wrong with it. We're still eating off Billy Mitchell's dishes up there at our hunting camp. Still got dishes that he packed in there. They left a lot of plunder in there, of course. They just abandoned it, walked off and left it. And those boys salvaged it and used that stuff for years and years and years.
Did the telegraph act go all the way to Nome?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah.
This wasn't the first, way back in the 60s or so, there was this telegraph that they were trying to put in.
Oh, well.
I didn't
there was no landline.
There was no line laid in that?
Oh, no.
Was
oh, but not to Nome.
No, not to Nome.
That was done in 1905 or 6, I believe.
That was the original military telegraph, but you said there was no line laid at that time.
No.
That was just a survey.
I didn't know that survey.
Exactly.
We're talking about Allen,
mm-hmm.
Not Allen.
No. That line went as far as St. Michael's, and then they had the longest wireless last in the world from St. Michael's to safety. And from there, they were telling us some of that line that they didn't know. That was 100 miles across the.
Yeah, stop this just a minute. The voice has been spread.
No, the line went right to the, speaking of the telegraph line, the line Mitchell put in, incidentally, Arnie D. House was a packer for him, too. He lived around here for many years in Fairbanks. In fact, his boy, Arnold D. House, lives here now. And he was a packer for Billy Mitchell on that job. He was one of his packers. Now that line went right up from Big D up the left limit of the Tanana to the mouth of Good Pasture, crossed over and went right up the Good Pasture River, right all the way till they ran out of water and dropped over into over the divide. No, those are old mail. That's the old dog team mail trail. Those are old dog team mail trail bridges across the Clearwater. That trail went up to Keeley and Good Pasture first. There's a big village at the mouth of the river there. It's a Good Pasture, tremendous village, a couple of thousand natives, yes, and. And in those days, of course, there wasn't too much traffic outside of the prospectors, but in 1909, when our friends moved on to the river, there was no game there. Moose were gone, they'd been cleaned out. They even used beaver for food, you know, and there weren't even any beaver on the river in those days. But. Of course, were a lot of people too, and they were living off the country. They used to. And we saw a lot of those people in the early days. They used to come in here. I've seen a lot of them come up from China by canoe, and I know Frank has. They used the old birch bark canoe in those days, build their own canoes, paddle up.
Did you see the old birch bark canoe?
Oh yes, oh yes.
I've never seen one.
Oh yes, The Chena Indians have used them all the time, don't they? Yeah. Well, that the Valdez Eagle line couldn't possibly have gotten near the Alaska Highway. It just
crossed. Had to cross it.
No. No? Oh, no, it didn't go that way at all. Oh, well, oh, yes, it came right into Big D. It came right into Big D. It didn't...
It went across Gold Creek and went up Willow. I followed it. And went up Willow Creek from Gold Creek and then crossed on down into
Chicken. Well,
I followed an old Indian trail from Chicken, clear on over to Gold Creek. Sometimes walked it. It's like a road almost.
Well, there were probably other lines too. But what the excuse for it would be, I don't know. I know that the reason the line was laid in Deagle, of course, was that was the only judge we had in the interior was in Eagle, and we had one in Nome, and we had one in Southeastern, didn't we? I think we had three judges. Well, I don't know. Mitchell was the guy in charge of laying the line. Actually, he wasn't. As far as I know, he wasn't stationed anyplace. He was strictly a construction man. He had charge of the building of the line. And there's a lot of country in there, and when you get up the hill to Good Pasture, it gets a little rugged. You're up about 5,000 feet. That when you go up there to drop over into the 40 mile, now you're up 5,000 feet. There's sheep in those hills, mountain sheep. So they're not hunted, but they're there. I've seen them. You know, I don't know what the mountain is, but up there, about 10 miles from where we had the courts there on Tim Street. You know where that is?
Yeah, I'm
good. Oh, were you?
Yeah.
May I ask the question, Johnny? What do you remember about these graveyards and villages? I seen the natives placing paper flowers on the graves a couple of years ago. What do you ever hear about that?
Well, all I remember about them is that we left them alone, and there was one up at Healy, and during that maneuver last winter, they just about put it out of commission. But, that was one thing.
Taboo to interfere with their grave?
As I understand it, you don't bother them. You leave them alone. They used to put a lot of their possessions on them, and I just always assumed that nobody touched them, that you just stayed away from them, or looked at them and didn't touch them. There's some terrific graveyards in Alaska, downriver particularly, around Mountain Village and some of those places. There are really some graveyards if they haven't been looted, but the only ones, of course, that I've been close to are ones like up on the hill there at Healy, and the people who are up there said that they just wrecked them last year.
Who wrecked them? The guys or people going in
there? Well, they had that operation, the big...
the military.
There were 6,000 military ran all over that country last year, and there's going to be about 15,000 in there this year. Sure, you can go up there in the wintertime and drive all over that country now with a four-wheel drive pickup or a truck. Go all over that country. Drive right into our cabin at Healy Lake. Blasted roads and trails all over the place. Yeah, they knocked the right of ways out there. It looked just like the right of way for the REA line, you know. You come around a bend, you look up 15 miles up towards the hill, and you can see a swath right through the hill, like you see these cuts out here when you're driving along the highway. No kidding. They put some equipment through there, and they really bulldozed that country up, believe me. But, Oh, yeah, you couldn't, you can't get over it, of course, in the summertime, I mean, but when it's frozen, Bill Stoker drove right into Healy Lake, you know. But, oh,
It's one of those things, you know, there's a lot of that stuff.
Well, another thing that I'd like to ask you, do you remember much about the school band?
No. I can't remember, though, when we didn't have one.
We
always had them, as far as I know. We always had a school band when I was in school. No, my brother played it too, but that was enough.
You remember the old gray yard at Monkey Hill there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I guess that's gone.
Yeah. I don't think there's a trace of it. I don't know. Maybe.
Well,
at one time, boy, you could drive by there and see all the graves up there. There were all kinds of graves there on the hill. The good pasture graveyard all went into Tandaw. When I first went up there 30 years ago, there was a big graveyard, and it's all cut away. I don't think there's a grave left on land now. I think they're all in the river. The Tandaw moves around so much. Chopped them all. Oh, yeah, you know, Jim mentioned foot races. Well, believe me, in the early days, the foot races were pretty important, you know, around here. In the tug of war, the Russians and the Swedes always had that tug of war on the 4th of July. They used to bet a lot of money. They had one right out here in front of the Nordale and Fairview Hotel on First Street. Well, we're pretty close to it, you know. Fairview's right here, and the Nordale Hotel was right out where the USO is. And they had those races between there and the wooden bridge, and a lot of the races used to go around the First and Second Street block, and we had a lot of good baseball in those days too. The 4th of July was a big day. We had a 3 or 4 day celebration, of course. A lot of foot races and bike races and the tug of war, and then finally Bobby Sheldon and the Model T Fords came in, and we started to have auto races. We had a half mile track out in Weeks Field, and we had the old Model T's used to race out there. Tom Gibson had a lot of the old racers. Kept them for years down here in Wendell. I don't know what happened to them, but they were still there when Tom left. He had the... It could very well have been. That was our... I think that's where the Zeppelin... Yeah. That probably was what that was, although we did have a real good... Right at Gillam Way. Right where the Arctic Bowl is. Where the Alaska Bowl is where the Zeppelin Field was. But we had that half-mile dirt track, and so I recall old Roy Lund was one of our great athletes in the early days. He was quite a bike rider, a fellow who used to drive the stage from here to Big Delta, Roy Lund. He's been coming back to Alaska. He's still kicking.
No,
he is.
Yeah.
Gee, it just seemed like last summer I saw him. Well, he was no kid. You know, he must have been pushing 90, maybe. He's getting pretty old. But,
did Wada run up here? Like, is Wada the gap?
I don't think so. Did he, Frank?
Oh, yeah.
Did he run here?
Ran in
Milmine, 50
mile
race there. That's
had some good horse races. Yeah. Used to have good horse races. Well, they had some dandy horses. Miss Cascade used to always put on Max on the 4th of July. She was quite a rider. Just the Blanche Cascade was riding it.
Another thing I'd like to ask about the dog races. They always used to run right
down 1st Avenue on the river. Well, when I was a kid, I don't remember dog races. I just don't remember them. First race I ever remember much was one, and that was in modern times.
That's about
1920. Yeah, 20, it was in the 20s anyway.
Now, I don't remember the dog races before that. Do you, Frank?
Yeah, they started
about 1956. They did. They did, huh? I just don't recall those at all. Of course, there were a lot of dogs around, but there were thousands of dogs around here, but I don't remember the races. They had some fine teams. Frank Wiseman had a real team. I remember Frank Wiseman's team. Perfect team. He was a U.S. Marshal. The government had some good dog teams in those days. And of course, they did all their patrolling by dog teams. Yeah. Well, he was in the Justice Department. Yeah, they had a lot of good dogs. Well, I don't know, but when Frank was going to school, I'll tell you, to get back to school, there's this thing my mother told me, and believe me, it still existed when we were kids. The school teacher better not sign up for a job unless he or she was able to handle the biggest guy in the class, because we used to have some knockdown dragamouts. I can remember them going at it, but good. The teachers and the kids fighting, you know, we had some dandies. They were good ones. And we had quite a some of the kids going to school, and I was getting up in the 6th or 7th grade. We had kids in high school that I'm sure were 22 years old still going to school. Some of those guys are pretty old. They were men, you know. Pretty tough. But,
Did you ever try your hand at mine?
Oh, yes. You betcha. Yeah.
How about a little bit
of
experience
with that? I got some $6,000 monument over at Langley. I never got a color out of it. Yeah. Yeah, I tried my hand in mine quite a few times. I did a lot of grub staking and had interest in a lot of big egg patches. But, you know, the end of the year we got a little air of sunshine, you know. I had 8% of a sixth of a third of a hunk of coffee up in the cold buck, and 25 people bought it. I gone into Livingood and a bunch of guys, and we lost several thousand dollars in a couple of seasons over there, and I had a chance then to acquire a little interest in what I thought was just another blueberry patch up on the Cobuck. They've been prospecting up there now for about 5 years. Kennecott has, and the other day, they paid $3 million out the 31st of December for those claims. Well, I got a check for a few thousand bucks.
Just, I
was
started way back in
the 1898, the Klondike. Oh, sure. It's like the oil and everything else. I mean, they need oil someplace, and everybody gets excited, but, most of those places they knew the oil was there, and in some of the places they pumped it. And a long time ago, I sold Catala oil. I sold the last of the Catala oil over at the State Oil Company in 1928-1929. About 500 barrels of oil that was refined at Catala before the refinery burned.
Was that about
the time it burned? I don't know when it burned, but we had the tag. It must have burned before that because there was no more oil. We had a tag end of the oil. We had about 500 barrels of it over there. We sold it, and now they're putting together a drilling deal right back at Catala. There's a company going in there and drill. And, well, of course, there's a lot of activity oil-wise, but this copper deal up on the Cobuck is
is going to be a really important part of our economy. It's the biggest news, actually, and it's been played down, but it's the biggest news since they hit oil on the Kiva as far as Alaska is concerned, because it's...
How will they get it out of there? Right down the river to...
Well, I think they're going out with a railroad myself, but then...
It's the only way to
see
it possible.
I imagine right now the people who bought those copper players would like to have some cheap power. what they're going to use for power, I don't know. Well, I think they'll be mining copper before they build Rampart Dam, Paul. I don't like to sound unenthusiastic, but I think it's going to take quite a while. Well, I want to thank you for inviting me, and now I'm going home and spend the rest of the night unpacking and packing to go to Juneau.
Well, now, I'd like to ask you one thing on the end of this tape. If we get a Pioneer home here at Fairbanks, will you figure on going in it when you retire?
Well, I'm not really retired, but if they get a Pioneer home in Fairbanks, as good as the one that we have in Scripture, I would never hesitate to enter it, because the Pioneer home in Scripture is first class. I've been there quite a few times. Wonderful place.
Let's hope you help us get it.
Oh, we're working on it.
That's the end of Johnny Badovich's story, and we'll resume our meeting and close up for the evening.